Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. What do we really know about the impact of biotechnology on agriculture, food safety, and the environment? Well, we know there have been many claims and counterclaims in the past few years. We know that so-called GMO varieties account for a large percentage of the corn and soybean acres planted in the U.S., as well as many other crops. We also know that consumers in Europe and Asia, and many of us in the United States, are nervous about eating the products of agricultural biotechnology. But how do we as consumers and citizens really make sense of the claims and counterclaims and make good choices as biotechnology, so to speak, evolves? During this hour, Focus 580, we'll pursue one strategy for making sense of the biotechnology mess by probing the history of its development. Our guest is a science reporter who has been covering the story for most of the past decade. Daniel Charles is a technology correspondent for National Public Radio and Washington correspondent for New Scientist. During this hour, we'll talk with Daniel Charles about his book, Lords of the Harvest, Biotech, Big Money, and the Future of Food, recently published by Perseus. In the book, he covers the big biotechnology breakthroughs in competing academic and corporate laboratories, the actors and their hopes for feeding the world and windfall profits, and the detractors of biotechnology and the popular resistance they engendered. From all that, we may even be able to draw some reasonable conclusions about the perils and promise of biotechnology, and indeed our existing commercial model of agriculture for sustaining a population of 6 billion and counting. As we talk with Daniel Charles, I have a bunch of questions, but I will defer to yours if you would like to phone us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states our signal reaches, or via the internet anywhere in the U.S. You can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Daniel Charles, good morning.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Great. Well, let's begin with some basics. Biotechnology has been around for a long time. One could say thousands of years, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose.
But the phase of the revolution most people mean when they use the word biotechnology really started in the early 80s. Can you talk about where and how it began?
Right. Well, it was, in a sense, the application to plants of some gene splicing techniques that had been perfected with bacteria. So in the late 70s, they'd figured out how to get new foreign genes into particular bacteria and use them as factories, for instance, for producing pharmaceuticals, drugs. And a lot of people's minds raced ahead and said, ah, we can do things with plants. We can make plants with strange and unusual new powers. There was kind of a wave of enthusiasm that washed across the country in 79, 80, 81, and a lot of companies jumped aboard it, a lot of little startups, some big ones. Notable among them was Monsanto, which forged to the front, you might say, through a combination of kind of personal serendipity, you might say, who they managed to have good contacts with, and, you know, corporate resolve. And in 1983, at the very beginning of 1983, the first, what you might say, genetically engineered plants, ones that had genes kind of spliced into them using these new techniques, were growing in laboratories. But it took a very long time before they actually ended up on anybody's dinner table.
Right. There, you write that there are three pillars of the genetic engineering of plants. Can you describe what they are?
As a scientific matter, yeah. The three pillars, you might say, were the ability to isolate the gene that you wanted, and second, the ability to get that gene into a plant cell, which turned out to be, compared to bacteria, quite hard to do. Plant cells have this kind of hard wall around them that acts like a, I don't know, kind of a Berlin Wall, keeping out any new genes. And the third element of it, often neglected, is the ability to coax that plant cell, you know, to into life, so to speak, to grow in a petri dish into a whole plant. Those were the scientific frontiers that confronted people in the laboratory, scientists in the very early 80s. And those three problems were solved, you might say, almost simultaneously in different corners of the scientific world. At a laboratory at the university in St. Louis, two laboratories really that collaborated in Belgium and Germany, and in the laboratories of Monsanto, which kind of piggybacked onto the work that these other scientists had been doing in the universities. They established consulting agreements in the years before this with some of these academic laboratories. These academic scientists had been working on the problem for, you know, let's say a decade. Monsanto came along, and within a few short years, with some very young scientists just out of university, were able to kind of leapfrog the work that was being done in the academic laboratories, really by taking advantage of these sharing relationships and then carrying it forward.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, Monsanto had very good scientists, but they also had these consulting agreements, as you mentioned, where they could sort of look over the shoulders of these other researchers.
They absolutely looked over the shoulders of the academic researchers. And, you know, it's an interesting thing to go back into this history, because it has an effect on the way people see it today. Within Monsanto, which is kind of the company that I concentrate on in my research in the book, because they were there at the beginning, and they're there kind of, you know, preeminent among the agricultural biotech companies today. You know, this initial breakthrough, this scientific accomplishment in the very early 80s within the company, within Monsanto, was kind of their creation myth, you know, their story of origin. And as it's told within the company, it's an inspiring story of scientific genius, really. The reality is a much more complicated one. I'm not saying, you know, and I will not say that Monsanto simply stole this, you know, this knowledge. What they did do is they took advantage of a tradition of kind of scientific sharing just at the time when science was changing and people were increasingly establishing private ownership over such discoveries. So Monsanto was very careful to try to go and patent things as soon as they invented them. And some of the academic laboratories were somewhat slower on the uptake with that in that regard.
I'm glad you mentioned the patent issue. You're right, the patents are the bedrock on which the biotechnology industry is built. And maybe we could also, you know, backing up a bit, ask you to talk about a key decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1980 dealing with patent rights for such organisms.
Right. In 1980, the Supreme Court decided the so-called Chakrabarty case, which had been winding its way through the courts for many years. And, you know, by the time it was decided, actually, the actual scientific discovery that was being debated was no longer very relevant or very important. It had been superseded. But as a legal matter, I mean, the question at issue was, could this bacterium that a man named Ananda Chakrabarty had invented when he was working for General Electric, could this bacterium, this genetically altered organism, be patented? Could a company claim private ownership for a while, or at least rights to the use of this bacterium for 17 years for itself? And the Supreme Court decided in 1980, yes, you know, this genetically altered organism can be considered an invention, a product of the human hand, you know, like a new machine. That really kind of was a crucial decision for the emerging biotech industry, because they said, okay, if we make something, we can claim it as our private property. It's not immediately in the public domain that anybody and everybody can use. We can make some money on this. That was very important, and that became very important for Monsanto, too, as it and all the other biotech companies as they pursued genetically altered, genetically engineered plants.
We're talking this morning with Daniel Charles. He's a technology correspondent for National Public Radio, and we're discussing his book, Lords of the Harvest, Biotech, Big Money, and the Future of Food. We actually have a caller waiting from San Francisco, so I'll include them in our conversation. And the number around Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our listener on line number 4 in San Francisco. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, morning, all. I don't know if you in Chicago were lucky enough to see the San Francisco Mime Troupe. They were just there about a month ago, and they did a great performance piece on at the GE issue. But I was mostly interested in the economics of this. Everything has its weak linchpin, and certainly the economics of this, the lawsuits that are potential for damaging other crops. I understand there's a Canadian farmer that recently lost a lawsuit. He alleged that the drift of spores landed on his organic farm, and that Monsanto had essentially tainted his organic fields, and in fact he lost that lawsuit. But the concept of this genetically engineered or genetically modified material that's essentially allowing Monsanto to steal farmers' property if they're caught using these genetically modified products and they're not paying the royalties. It's actually a very interesting kind of a land grab, but it still seems like there must be a potential economic weakness to the Monsanto GE position, and I'm just wondering if you can give us some ideas about that.
Should I go ahead?
Yeah, sure. Excellent questions. Go ahead.
This gets into a very involved and interesting set of issues, and I think they're the heart of the whole story. You go on a lot of talk shows, and the immediate question is, well, is this safe to eat?
Right.
I don't find the genetically engineered things on the market scary to eat. I think from all that I've been able to sort of figure out and from all that's known on this, I agree with the government on this. I think they are safe to eat. What's more interesting, actually, is the story when it comes to the changing nature of the seed, the changing nature of the plants as a legal and commercial matter. I think the thing that is truly new and different about these seeds is not so much their biology as their legal and commercial nature. Now, you also have to say there's been a lot of mythology that's grown up around this. So let's take this case that the caller mentioned of the farmer in Canada. His name's Percy Schmeiser. And it's not, by the way, an organic farm that he runs by any means. He and the case was decided against him. The essential problem that was raised by that case is, well, back up a little bit. I think probably many of your listeners, at least who are involved in agriculture in that area, they know the deal when you buy these genetically engineered seeds from Monsanto. For instance, in the case of soybeans that have been engineered to tolerate sprays of a herbicide called Roundup, or corn plants that have been engineered to be resistant to insects. In all those cases, if you buy the seed, you sign a deal that says they're for one-time use only, so to speak. I mean, you plant the Roundup-ready soybeans, and you can harvest what grows and sell it, but you cannot save part of that and plant it as seed for the following year. That's the contract you sign. Now, if you violate that, Monsanto can sue you. And if you've signed the contract, they have a very strong legal case because basically you knew the deal when you signed up, when you bought the seed. In the case of Percy Schmeiser, he never signed a contract. He got his seed somehow, but he did not buy it from Monsanto or any Monsanto dealer. Now, Percy Schmeiser, the heart of his case and where I think he stood on strongest ground was to say, I never signed a contract. So Monsanto shouldn't have any legal leverage over me. Now, he also came up with a theory which the judge did not buy, and I think based on the evidence is not true, about how the Roundup-ready canola, in his case, grew in his field because the wind blew the pollen in. That story really does not stand up. In my mind, that's not crucial. The question, Monsanto asserted that no matter where you got the seed, and Monsanto believes that Percy Schmeiser got it from a neighbor, if you got the seed and it contains our patented genes, you've got to pay us because you are intentionally planting this and we somehow own that seed. because we've got rights to it because of these patents. Monsanto won that case, but it's on appeal, and I think it's sort of a shaky decision for you know, a number of reasons. You know, that basically it should be an illegal thing to plant seed that contains Monsanto's patented genes, even if you don't spray Roundup or take advantage of that new gene. I don't know. It's a quirky kind of case. But in any case, I hope that illuminates some of the issues.
Well, what I was interested in was, I mean, it does to a degree, but what I was more interested in is it, it's kind of like, you know, as giants get bigger, their knees get weaker. So the idea that, for example, looking at this as a land grab, that Percy Schmeiser essentially spent so much money that he's going to have to lose some of his land to pay off the legal debts. And if you look at this in terms of a mega giant corporation that was interested more in taking more and more possession of land across America or the world for that matter, that if farmers are going to be forced to pay outrageous legal expenses for every tiny infraction, and that the larger the corporation gets, the more they're going to have the ability to write off any problems on the taxpayer, and that the farmers will never be able to compete against these corporations that are eventually going to usurp all of the land. There has to be some economic weakness to this that will allow common sense to get small farmers back in production and mega giant corporations out of the control of the food sources. So I'm just wondering if there was some economic linchpin that you can spot in this that will help farmers get some real control of their lives back.
Well, I have to say I disagree a little bit with the premise of that question, because I think the thing that Monsanto is working against here, their real weakness is they're basically going against biology. They're trying to assert control over something that naturally reproduces out there in the field. That's a battle that they have taken on. They have decided that they are going to try to make seed a product like any other product, like a car, as opposed to something that, yes, you can help create, but it escapes your control the way seed normally does, which is, you know, kind of been the bane of the seed industry since its beginning. You know, you sell a seed and it, by its very nature, reproduces and beyond your control. That's the battle that Monsanto has taken on, and that's why you end up with situations where they you know, try to employ their legal arsenal in order to keep biology under control, so to speak, to keep farmers like whoever sold Percy Schmeiser the seed from doing that. So I think that's the basic weakness that they're up against. And you see it, for instance, they cannot charge large amounts of money for Roundup Ready soybeans anywhere else in the world except North America. Well, probably they could in Europe if they were selling it in Europe. But for instance, in Argentina, they can make money on the herbicide in by selling Roundup in Argentina, but they cannot charge large amounts for the seed because in Argentina they haven't been able to convince the government that seed saving should be illegal. So that's the reality. I think if you're looking for a weakness, an economic weakness on the part of Monsanto, that's it.
Okay, it just crosses my mind then that the one aspect of it is that since most humans, most citizens of the country, of this country, and perhaps getting into the world, are not involved in agriculture anymore, they are, and they're going to be asked to serve on juries in some cases, that the economic premise that they're going by, that seeds are not the product of nature or God, but that they're the product of scientists and corporation, that education of the public in this, so that when they get to juries, they're going to be able to look at it from a more logical viewpoint as opposed to an economic skewed viewpoint.
Well, let me, just for the sake of the argument, let me then sort of spin out the argument that Monsanto would make to that jury, if you'll permit me.
Sure.
The Monsanto argument would be, listen, these are useful things, these traits that we've created. Roundup Ready soybeans may not cut the use of pesticides that much. It may not even save the farmer that much money. It does substitute a less toxic chemical for more toxic chemicals that farmers have been using. It certainly makes the farmer's job easier. It's certainly been popular. How are we supposed to bring these useful things to the market if we can't charge for them? How are we supposed to do that? So that's why we absolutely need to take these steps that we've taken. That'll be Monsanto's argument. And, you know, I have to say, both sides hold some validity for me.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. I have another listener I'll get to in just a minute. Let me just ask you, since we're almost in our midpoint, I want to sort of establish some of the themes in the book, and then we'll take some more callers. I want to ask you to talk about Monsanto as the site of much of the research and development. What was the culture like? What did the scientists there believe they were doing, and for what purpose?
Well, this is, yeah. I mean, the group that was established within Monsanto in the early 80s, the biotech group, they kind of felt themselves to be the green revolutionaries within the company. It's an interesting sort of thing, and it and they were this small group, felt like, you know, they were the biology people within a company dominated by chemical you know, people. They also, and you can argue whether this is a rationalization after the fact, kind of a cynical justification for themselves, or whether they, you know, had reason to believe this. But the fact is, they did believe it, that they were going to do great things for the world. Monsanto, as a company, you'll have, you know, other people within the industry often describe Monsanto as arrogant. And that also kind of has its own reason, has its own story associated in, to some extent with the phenomenal success of this chemical they sell called Roundup, which was kind of dismissed early on, but Monsanto persuaded the world that Roundup was a useful and good and product, and it became this world beater. And then it, in the course of the years, the biology people kind of took over the company, so that by the mid-90s, a new CEO came to the top of the company who kind of got the biotech religion and became, this is the CEO named Robert Shapiro, believed in this very deeply, believed for whatever reasons that this was a terrific and wonderful thing for the world, for the environment of the world, and the company became quite messianic about the power and the usefulness of their technology. You know, the thing is, there's no one more self-righteous, I guess, or more deaf to criticism than someone who believes that, than people who believe that they are on the moral right side. Perhaps that also sort of fed a dismissal of the critics on the part of Monsanto.
Now, that was my next question. How did they react when they started to be attacked by the environmental activists and the people concerned about, you know, food safety and so forth?
I'd say particularly in the early days, were quite dismissive.
They didn't take it seriously.
No, well, they. You know, that's a complicated thing because there are many different personalities within the company. You know, in the mid-90s, in the late-90s, there were some within the company, some, for instance, in the Washington office of the company, who felt like these criticisms were potentially quite powerful and quite damaging to the company, and recommended a much more sort of proactive and engaging and even compromising stance. But what ultimately carried the day in the company headquarters in St. Louis was an attitude that we know that these products are safe. We know we've got government approval for them. We know from our history with some earlier products we brought on the market in earlier years, notably a growth hormone in dairy cattle, that there will be some very vocal opponents who will be against us because they don't like us, but the public, these people at Monsanto thought, won't care that much, so we're just going to kind of power on through. That carried the day in Monsanto up until kind of the roof fell in, I suppose, in late in mid-99.
We'll talk more about that in a minute. Let me just, first of all, reintroduce our guest during this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with Daniel Charles. He's a technology correspondent for National Public Radio, and he's the author of the book we're discussing, Lords of the Harvest, Biotech, Big Money, and the Future of Food, recently published by Perseus Publishing. We do have a caller waiting and would welcome others in the time remaining. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Let's include a listener in Eureka next on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
So, I'm going to inquire about a nutrition terminology. Now, they sometimes use a group designation and that sort of thing. Like, well, they'll say GMO, and that refers, people know now what that's referring to and all. But there was a recent nutrition meeting down in St. Louis, and after that meeting, someone reporting talked about probio foods. And I wonder, now, you know, there are some things that are called like phytochemicals, and that, you know, that's kind of a group designation.
Sure.
And might you have ever known or heard, what is this probio? It has to do with foods and nutrition.
Does it have to do with genetic engineering? I don't know.
Probio, I have to say it's a new term for me.
I see.
I honestly don't know. I mean, if you're talking about nutrition, everybody's kind of waiting in the field of genetic engineering for the genetically engineered products that you can sell to the consumer with the promise of benefits to their health. There hasn't been a product really on the market available for sale yet that kind of fits that criteria. The industry is waiting anxiously for the product that will kind of change the perception of GMOs, of genetically engineered food, in the public's mind, to be something instead of something that farmers like to plant, to be something that consumers want to buy because it reduces blood pressure or has other nutritional benefits.
Sure, lower fat or higher protein or whatever.
For instance, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, maybe we can talk more about the future of the technology in a bit. But we do have a couple callers waiting and someone on a car phone on line number four. Let's talk with them next. Good morning, you're on Focus 580. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, that's you.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, you are.
This is State Representative Dale Grubb in Indiana. I'm a farmer, and we have this passation. I carried a couple of pieces of legislation and look to carry again this session. Wanted to make a few points that maybe Daniel could comment on.
Okay.
First of all, one of my main concerns is seed purity cannot be guaranteed anymore. And under current court interpretations, any farmer out here could be liable for possession of the gene, even though the seed, which may have been, in his mind, non-GMO, contained the genetic material, so I'm very concerned about that. Another point is the cost of the litigation. Part of the package that we put together says that if the farm is ultimately found not to be liable, that he be made whole in the process of whatever court costs he has spent. Another provision requires third-party independent sampling when tests are taken in the countryside to see if the GMO is present. Another point I would like to make concerns the Chakrabarty case. It's my opinion that is not a clear-cut case in relation to what we're discussing today, and it has been Patent Office extension of legislative intent, which I believe was quite clear at the national level when the amendment to add sexually reproducing genes to the statute for protection was defeated in the U.S. House of Representatives. So hopefully that's helpful. I'll go offline and turn my radio back on.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, nice to hear from the state representative. Let me start with the last thing first. He's absolutely right about the Chakrabarty case, that the Patent Office went well beyond the Chakrabarty case over the years in allowing patents on various things, not just plant genes and plants. And I've tried to sort of figure out what my own position is on where the line ought to be drawn, and I've eventually come to the position, and I could be persuaded otherwise, probably, because these are complicated issues that people can disagree about. But I've come to the position that particular kinds of genes that have been so altered so much in the laboratory that they really are not anymore kind of products of nature that we simply kind of got our hands on and used, but that, for instance, this the BT gene that's put into corn, or the Roundup resistance gene that's put into soybeans, particularly the BT gene, just use that, the one that makes corn poisonous to insects. That thing has been completely rewritten in order to make it work in plants. It's had new signals, you know, new sort of bits of DNA attached to it to make it turn on and function within plants. Took many years of work to do this, and that gene does not exist in nature. It is the product of the human hand, and I actually believe that a patent on such a thing is a perfectly reasonable thing. But on the other hand, there's actually a Supreme Court case going on right now about this. I don't think that plants in their totality ought to be patentable, because there, you know, if it's applied widely by seed companies, it has the effect of kind of locking up the whole gene pool.
Mm-hmm.
Plant breeders cannot use, you know, another company's variety as an element in a breeding program to make a new and better plant. I think that has a bad effect. So I'm against patents on plants as such, but I'm willing to agree that patents on some genes may be a fine thing. Now, this issue about seed purity and liability to Monsanto, again, I wouldn't necessarily be against a law of such a law, but I don't think it's necessarily needed, because, you know, the fact of the matter is Monsanto is not going after farmers because they, through no fault of their own, have some contamination in their fields. That is simply not the case. And, you know, if this is inspired again by this Canadian case of Percy Schmeiser, yes, there should be third-party tests. There should be much more clarity on exactly what, for instance, was planted in Percy Schmeiser's field. But, you know, the evidence seemed to indicate he had practically pure Roundup Ready canola growing in his field. And there are different stories for how he got that. But, you know, this is not a case where he got some contamination and suddenly Monsanto came in and sued him just because of that.
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up on that. Monsanto, though, perhaps partially earned its reputation for arrogance in, you know, essentially advertising for neighbors to turn their neighbors in if they suspected they were replanting Roundup Ready seed.
Right. No, it's No, I mean, Monsanto may be respected for its accomplishments, but in this, this very ambitious attempt to change the rules of the game in the seed business, they offended an awful lot of people. I mean, I grew up on a farm. My father was a farmer. My brother still runs the farm. I showed my brother some of these things that I'd come across. He hadn't actually seen them in his home area, which is in Pennsylvania. It's not a huge soybean area. You know, but he kind of shook his head, chuckled, and said, well, that's not exactly promoting neighborliness, is it? It rubs people the wrong way.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. This is a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, hello. Your guest likes to talk about the economics of the situation, but if he means by that merely going for the bottom line, I mean, that's a very shallow way of looking at our economy. There are places, and there is a place for institutions to impose moral, ethical, the big picture kind of viewpoint on companies, and it just isn't a sufficient argument to merely say, you know, well, if how else are we going to bring these genetically engineered things to the market if we don't get a special profit for it? Which kind of brings me to my question. I'm going to have to ask it and hang up.
Okay.
Danella Meadows from Dartmouth wrote, the scientists who are doing the work, many of whom I know and respect, are just that, scientists. Engrossed by the technical challenges, oblivious to the evolutionary, ecological, economic, or social consequences, unquote. So a couple of things your guest has said imply at least that he knows differently, and I'd like him to argue or point out some incidents where he found that these technical scientists were actually thinking about social consequences, the evolutionary, and if they had any kind of the ecological impacts, and if they had any kind of expertise in that. Now I'll hang up.
Okay, thanks for the question.
I'm not exactly sure what the caller was referring to, and as far as things that I said that implied that they had deep knowledge of all those things. No, I would agree that the scientists working on these things tend to know a lot about the specific thing they're working on, and to have great pride of authorship in that accomplishment, and believe that it technical accomplishment also meant something good for the world and also valuable to their company. In many cases, I think they were mistaken in that. I would also say, though, that in the process of this development, some of these companies were, in fact, forced to take account of some of the other aspects of some of the implications of their work. An example of that would be when they came up with BT crops, these crops that are essentially poisonous to a particular class of insects. This came on the horizon in the mid-80s. By the late 80s, every time these companies went out and talked to any public gathering, you know, there would be somebody who would stand up and say, yeah, but the insects will evolve. You'll have resistant
right.
insects on your hands.
Sure.
And not your tool will be defeated, and also you will have ruined the effectiveness of essentially a gift of God, you know, this bacterium that gave us the gene that has this effect, because it will now be ineffective. And you can argue about whether the companies went far enough. I think particularly in the case of cotton, they have not been forced to go far enough. But the companies were forced to put in place some kind of plan to try to reduce the chances that resistance would emerge. And interestingly, this is the case in a genetically engineered product, but it is not the case in any other insect-resistant crop that comes on the scene that's created by plant breeders. It's not the case when, for instance, a new chemical comes on the market that insects can also become resistant to. So in a sense, you know, the genetically engineered products that have come on the market have been subjected to a higher standard of kind of ecological consciousness. And I think that's a good thing. I think that ought to be applied to other technologies that come on the market, whether that's an insect-resistant plant that's created by the plant breeders as opposed to the genetic engineers, and also new chemicals that are applied. There ought to be restrictions to delay, if not prevent, the emergence of resistance.
We have just about 10 minutes left with our guest, Daniel Charles, author of the book Lords of the Harvest, Biotech, Big Money, and the Future of Food. We have one caller waiting. I'll get right to. Others are welcome in the time remaining. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll get to our next caller really quickly, but I did want to ask you one question that sort of gets to this heart of, you know, the clash between corporate profits and public welfare. In the discussion of developing biotech agricultural products, you know, there has been a lot of sort of talk of feeding the world, and this is something for the public good, not just private profit. But you make the point, I think it's an important one, that the vast majority of the world's farmers lie beyond the limits of commercially viable seed trade. And so what does that mean? What are the implications of that?
Well, you know, I think at a very minimum, the implications are, let's say, twofold. One is many of the claims made on behalf of this technology, you have to say that they're made, you know, for public relations purposes. This technology has been pushed forward primarily by private companies, and it remains and it's been pushed into the marketplace on a massive scale for in the crops that promise the greatest economic return, and in the countries where the profits the profit potential is greatest. That is, corn and soybeans in North America and Argentina. So the vast, all these, to start an advertising campaign saying, genetic engineering is going to be a wonderful thing for the poor farmers of the world, you got to say that that's really just public relations. It's an attempt to improve the image of this technology. Now, at the same time, I actually think that genetic engineering could be a useful tool in some cases. And this leads to the second implication of the reality of the world, and that is that it's important, if you really want to make this tool available for farmers who can't pay for it, basically, you've got to just donate the technology to the people, for the most part, nonprofit and government-funded researchers around the world, whose job it is, who've kind of taken on the task of delivering tools, better crop varieties, and so forth, to those poor farmers. So some of that is actually happening. The companies have donated a fair amount of tools. It's happening in fits and starts, and as you'd expect, without the marketing and distribution power of the companies behind it, it's proceeded rather slowly. But that's unfortunately, I think that's the reality. The only way it's going to reach those farmers, if the tools turn out to be useful, is going to be through this publicly funded, underfunded research and distribution system.
This is an important point, just to sort of underline, I promise I'll get it right to the callers. But we had a chance to talk with M.S. Swaminathan recently about this very issue, and the sort of his point was, we're trying to develop varieties through traditional methods and increasingly looking at biotechnology to, deal with rice, cassava, all these other crops that, poor farmers around the world depend on and need to grow more of because the populations are growing, obviously. But our research budget is minuscule compared to Monsanto and some of these other corporations.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely right. So, if you're interested in the plight of the poor around the world, and an awful lot of those poor live in rural areas, you can't kind of consider them farmers in the North American sense. They happen to have some land, and the thing that they can do with it is grow some things. It's only the publicly funded institutions that really have an incentive, really, to reach that population.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, someone south of Arcola on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a farmer, and I've read Daniel Charles' book, and I encourage people. He's an excellent storyteller. And one of the things I learned is the dynamics behind the scene that have changed my choices when I buy seed and chemicals today. And so I encourage people, Pages for All Ages was carrying the book several weeks ago, and if they're out now, I'm sure they'd be happy to buy some more. But this is a very readable book for those of us who are lay people, and he's a great storyteller. But one of the things I learned that explained what's happened to my life as a farmer is the reshaping of the seed and chemical industries that has at least been precipitated by Monsanto's role in biotech. When they saw the cash stream coming from the tech fees on Roundup Ready products, they went on a buying spree and started buying seed companies and other companies, which resulted in, as a kind of defensive move, consolidation among other seed companies and chemical companies, so that the familiar companies we used to deal with, and in some cases for generations and generations, are now owned by multinationals or have totally disappeared. And it seems to me what I want as a farmer is more choices, but what I have today is fewer choices, and as with the consolidation down the line in another generation, I'll have even fewer choices in companies I want to deal with and products that I want to buy. And then the other issue, as a farmer, one of the things that we do worry about is the price we get for our commodities. And our major ag organizations are all boosters on biotech, and I've raised it in the past. I don't have a problem in principle with it, but it does seem to me that at this point it's hard to argue that farmers have made any money off of this technology. The loss in confidence, whether it's justified or not, by the export market, and just a year ago with, it wasn't really Monsanto related, but a product that was released that wasn't approved for human consumption.
Yeah, Starlink.
Has taken a huge hit in the worldwide confidence in the American food supply, and I think our food supply is safe, but as a farmer, I'm going to raise for my market, and if my market has some mistaken ideas about, from my perspective, about what they want to eat, I'm still going to raise for the market. So I think it's hard to argue that farmers have benefited financially from biotech. There has been some convenience in the case of Roundup Ready soybean products, but I think we're going to pay a big price for that as time goes on.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
It's a delight to hear from a reader. No, the this issue of impacts on, for instance, on the seed industry, I think this is a serious one, and this is one of the big reasons why I'm against patents on plant varieties, because one effect of that is it makes it much harder for somebody to basically start a small seed company and be able to compete. Because increasingly, the big seed companies can use patents to basically lock up the gene pool, as I mentioned, and prevent a plant breeder from kind of, you know, getting access to the starting point. You know, the varieties that you need to breed out of in order to create more choices, really, for farmers. You know, on this issue of effect on markets downstream, yeah, I think. This has become a huge part of the story, and the story is not ended by any means, because the European Union is in the process of trying to put in place some new rules, which I may consider them unjustified and even silly, because they require the labeling of an ingredient in a food if that ingredient was derived from genetically engineered, for instance, soybeans, even if there is nothing genetically engineered left in the processed food. I mean, the specific case here is soy oil. Even if all the protein and all the DNA has been refined out of that oil, so there's nothing left that is genetically engineered, the label will still have to go on any food that uses that oil as an ingredient. And if that goes into effect, and if the food retailers in Europe decide that they just don't want to have that label on the food, they're going to be looking for much larger quantities of non-genetically engineered soy in the food supply. You know, American farmers have been put on the hook for this, and we'll see how it all plays out.
Well, that's probably a good point to end it on, because the story continues, and I would suggest for folks, if you'd like to learn more, certainly look for this book, because it's a very deep look at what's going on in this arena. The title is Lords of the Harvest, Biotech, Big Money, and the Future of Food, recently published by Perseus Publishing, and the author has been our guest, Daniel Charles. And to you, thanks so much for talking. It's been very interesting.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.